It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
It was another tough week for the Trump campaign, but what does all this mean for the Grand Ole Party? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Donald Trump began the week with a denial that he had done any of the things he said he'd done in a 2005 recording that captured his boasts of what would be considered sexual assault. Then came claims by a number of women who said they'd experienced such behavior, some reaching back decades. By midweek, the New York Times reported two women making such claims, followed by a third in People magazine. These were coupled with claims that Trump had walked into the dressing rooms of his beauty pageants, where contestants were in a state of undress. Recording has surfaced of Trump boasting of his ability to do just that. All of this hit the Trump campaign hard, with threats of lawsuits, particularly against the New York Times. His surrogates fought back furiously, saying they did not believe these women who had come forward. Trump himself reportedly fumed at the latest coverage and yesterday called all the allegations false. But this is the individual known as Donald Trump. What about the Republican Party that gave him the nomination? A number of GOP leaders have taken back their endorsements, and Trump has opened up a feud with House Speaker Paul Ryan. And what about his supporters who've dismissed the importance of these allegations? To sort all of this out and what it means for the GOP, in our studio this morning is Sean Bradley. He's with the Wicomico County Republican Party. Also, Greg Bassett with the Salisbury Independent. And welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Don.
Well, first, let me just get some initial reaction to the week's events and allegations and so on. Sean, I'll start with you first. I mean, as a matter of fact, the last we met actually in the morning. And by the afternoon, of course, the recording broke out. And then, of course, as the week has moved on, we've had the women come out and talk about their experience, their claims anyway. And then, obviously, Donald Trump's reaction. All of that's taken place in just a week's time. What's your reaction and what's your assessment of it?
My reaction is, I think it's funny to me that all these things happened out of the blue. Just at the final couple weeks, where were these allegations at the beginning of the campaign? Where were these allegations when they were 17 or 14 people running for the same position? It makes me think that it's I'm hoping these things aren't true, but again, we're all innocent until proven guilty. That being said, I think it's a great way for the Democratic side to fight back on all these, the email and the FBI investigation scandals.
Let me ask you a follow-up on that. Do you think that the Republicans who ran against him in the primary, they just didn't do their opposition research?
Absolutely. They didn't do their due diligence. If these things are true, then a lot of people, including the other side, dropped the ball. If these things are true, you should have never got to this point to begin with. If it is true, it's a great embarrassment. But if these things are not true and are not proven, it just goes to show these are just more than scandal tactics.
Craig, what about you? What was your reaction?
Well, I sort of see it as, when it came out, I wasn't that surprised because we all sort of know that Donald Trump doesn't live the kind of life that the rest of us live. He lives a life of his own choosing, and it just doesn't have the same basis for what most of us do in terms of how he travels and the amount of money he has. So he's clearly a different candidate, and these other Republicans that were running against him, they kept expecting him to fail. They were going to spend a lot of time on opposition research because people sort of knew who he was, and they all knew he was going to fail, yet he ends up being the nominee through the failures of the other contestants in that race. So we all knew this is what we were going to get with Donald Trump. He's a different kind of guy, but I don't know that takes away from what he's trying to do in terms of an issue. And when you think about what's going on the last 2 weeks, I haven't heard anyone talk about a policy issue in 2 weeks. I'm just hearing accusations and attacks. He's on the campaign trail attacking Paul Ryan. How does that get him elected president, attacking Paul Ryan? He needs to attack Hillary Clinton on some issues, and I would love to hear some sort of discussion about an issue, about Social Security, or, he talks about ISIS a lot, but there's nothing clear about what he's going to do with ISIS. As a consumer of news and as a someone who's going to vote, I would just love to hear the Republican candidate and even the Democrat talk about an issue instead of this back and forth, I said it, she said it. It's just an insult to the system, to all of us, that we're having to endure this character debate at this point in a race.
Let me ask you this, because I guess it's, for better lack of a better word, there's a Trump movement, at least it seems to me, that's occurred. The other day, he talked about how this was such an important election that we could lose our country. Is there such a thing as a Trump movement? And if so, is that separate do you think, or have peeled off from, say, the Republican, traditional Republican Party? What about you, Sean?
Yeah, I think that it does. Going back to one thing that Greg had said is that he's disavowing you know, Ryan and other GOP candidates to quote-unquote separate himself and increase his standing with the Trump movement. People are tired of politics as usual. He's doing everything he can to say, I'm not part of this guy. I'm not with this guy. I'm not with these people here. I am up myself. I am the movement that's going to move the party forward. So he's basically trying to market himself as the ultimate outsider, even if that means damning his entire party. Is that a good thing? I don't probably think so, but that's what he's doing. So people that are, the quote-unquote, the people that were Trump supporters from the start, hate government as usual. They want someone who's going to get things done without being bogged down by political red tape.
Greg, what about you? I mean, he talked about the other day, about enduring the slings and arrows, I guess, to steal a Shakespearean phrase, in order to stand up for the movement. Obviously, he was talking about the scandals. Does he represent a movement?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of very angry people out there. There are people who feel like what I said from the beginning of this thing, and I think maybe Peggy Noonan wrote it early on, that this has been a war on manners. People are tired of being told that they're politically incorrect. They're tired of what they perceive as other people getting advantages from the government that they don't get, either from taxes or healthcare or grants or some sort of developmental things. They're just tired of that. They're frustrated. They don't necessarily need it. I think they're tired of other people getting it and they don't understand it. And they're tired of being told that they don't know what they're talking about, that they don't understand America, that they can't say Oriental anymore. They have to say Asian. They don't understand the basis for these things. They don't understand why they can't have their guns. And it's a frustration, and they sort of react out of that through the Donald Trumps. The analogy I've used forever is in this race is that it goes back to 1968. This was always reminding me of that. Hillary Clinton is Richard Nixon. She's secretive. She's crippled. No one really likes her, but she's probably the most qualified person who's been in this race. Donald Trump is George Wallace. He's just out there saying crazy stuff, crazy by the standards of the mainstream media and the regular political world. He's pushing the envelope. He's got some wacky ideas. And there are people who are like, yeah. And he's saying what people have thought, but they're not allowed to say. And he's made it okay. So it's been like this war on manners that he's allowed to say this stuff. He's allowed to get away with it. The Mitt Romney thing from last week, Mitt Romney almost had to withdraw from the race, it seemed like, because he was being criticized for not hiring enough women. And he said, I have binders full of women. Well, that was immediately determined as sexist. Then you have what happened this past week in terms of defining sexism. It's on a whole nother level. I just can't believe how much things have changed in 4 years in terms of defining that.
Do you think that that their anger represents an anger against the changing demographics, against the changing sense of what we are as Americans? Greg?
I just think they don't connect with either President Obama or the Democrats. They don't connect with the Republicans. I was having this conversation with someone the other day. The Republican leadership right now, they're not very interesting people. When Paul Ryan gives a speech, I don't really care to listen to it. But when Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey and those guys used to talk, Bill Paxson, back in the 90s during the Contract with America, they had very interesting things to say. They wanted to do stuff to drive the country, to make change. They were a great counterpart to what Bill Clinton wanted to do. And Clinton, of course, centered himself to be on equal terms with them. But they had lots of great ideas, and I don't hear any great ideas coming out of the Republican leadership now. I'm just not inspired by any of the Republicans that are on the Hill. And when you talk about being effective, Donald Trump, if he's alienated his own party, which might not even be his party, I don't know, and the Democrats, how effective of a president can he be? How much change can he make if he doesn't have rapport with these guys? Because everyone wants to feel important. They want him to treat them like they're important, and he's not doing that. So I wonder, even if he wins, what the environment is going to be like.
Sean, what about this idea that they are reacting to these changes, which seem to be completely out of their control. We obviously know that the demographic changes. I think it was Ronald Reagan when he was elected. On a racial basis, there was 85% white electorate. We're now down to about 70-72% that expected to drop, with an increase, obviously, in Hispanics. You've got a changing economy globally, which many jobs have disappeared, which is something that Donald Trump has talked about. And so they're reacting to that change as well. Is the America that they once knew? In fact, I heard an interview with a woman who said, you know, the 1950s are really great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was a Trump supporter. That hauling back to some place that was different, is there something more fundamental going on here?
The fundamental thing people are saying is it's hard. It's because of regulations and crippling taxes. It's harder and harder for Americans to do business here in America. You know, it was better in the 50s because we look at the industry we had. Look at the industry versus today. You know, it's easier for a company to sell their goods and manufacture out of China because it's so much cheaper. At the same time, we also have Trump talks about this, is that China can import almost all they want here, but try to import American vehicles to China. It doesn't happen. Why is that? Is it because an apologetic or weak economic standpoint by our current administration? Is that the truth? Maybe. But I'm thinking that's where Trump's platforms would be strong and would be a good change.
Well, and the third thing I'm thinking about is that as you point out, the 1950s, obviously we had tariffs. We were on top of the world. Everybody else, by the way, had suffered something from the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And as we move forward, I mean, even in the 1960s, something like one third of the labor force and the non-governmental labor force was organized labor. So we were like this island. And the economy, the global economy, then seemed to kind of wash all of that away. Mm-hmm. So that now we have Donald Trump talking about, well, we got to regain something. Is that, and so I'm wondering whether or not, in part, that's one of the things that they're reacting to, that this is a change. That's, despite whoever was in power, whoever's in the White House, these changes were occurring. I mean, mm-hmm. I know, for instance, during the Reagan period, there was a thing called the Rust Belt. Mm-hmm. I mean, manufacturing was leaving even during the Reagan administration. This was long before the big free trade agreements. So it seems to me as if something more fundamental has hit these people, at least in terms of the perception of where they are.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm thinking maybe that American mm-hmm. Citizenship and business have grown complacent and relying on the government to give them all the answers. Mm. You know, I think that's we've kind of lost the mindset of going forward by our own strength, our own abilities and confidences, and allowing others to do it for us in the form of government.
That's a good point. I mean, when General Motors was in trouble and Obama went in there and bailed him out, I thought that was the dumbest thing he could ever do. Mm. But it worked. You know, so this is an example of the government taking an extreme step and it working. It was sort of done the same way where Bush bailed out the banks during the big recession. But General Motors came back and showed the American ingenuity that it needed. You know, it got the support from the government. I would have thrown the towel on them, but that worked. So that was one of those things that sort of schooled me, as a Republican, that there is a way that government can kind of help do things like this. But still, it's off the reservation in terms of what the government really probably should do.
Well, one of the things, Greg, that strikes me about all this is that when we're talking about free trade, the Republican Party has been the party of free trade. I mean, everybody talks about Clinton pushing NAFTA through. Well, it was Republicans who made that possible. And now we're seeing with Donald Trump, him taking on this, saying, well, you know, maybe you guys were wrong, that this was a bad thing. I mean,
Hillary has the Republican free trade position. She's more of a Republican free trader than Trump. I guess Trump would go back to, Bob Taft from Ohio, you know, sort of the not being a world person, an isolationist to a degree. And that's sort of what he's preaching, I think. But I'm not really sure, because I don't hear enough about what he wants to do. What it strikes me as, it occurred to me the other day, it's like reading a restaurant critic. You know, you read these reviews of their meals and they criticize everything, but they don't tell you how they would cook the food to make it better. And I feel like I'm in that loop right now where I hear lots of criticism, but I want to hear, all right, but this is what I'm going to do, you know, to make it better. And I'm not hearing that either from Hillary. Or from Donald Trump.
I think Trump has actually said that he wants to offer incentives to businesses to stay in America and do business in America, and maybe in the form of tax
right, cut
relief,
taxes,
you know, things that, like that.
Absolutely. I think if we keep people here, that's better. But there's also an argument to be had about what kind of jobs do we want Americans to do? So my favorite example is Rubbermaid. They make trash cans in Ohio. They make a lot of trash cans. They make superior products. But these are guys in Ohio who go to work every day and they make trash cans. So you come home at night, Daddy, what'd you do today? I made trash cans. So it just seems like with the intelligence that Americans have, there are other things that they could put their talents to. Let the Chinese and the Indians and those other people make trash cans. Why don't we make really important stuff that matters, like jets and cars. And that's what we do, and we need to specialize in that. We need to incentivize that. This green stuff, you know, with the windmills and all this other stuff, this great technology, the self-driving cars, those are the things that we should be doing as Americans. And let, you know, and this sounds awful, but let the uneducated people in the third world countries make the other stuff that doesn't take the skill sets that we as Americans have. So I would promote that somehow. I would want Americans making special, important things.
Let me just turn to something, and as a matter of fact, I mentioned this, Sean. Is there a connection, do you think, between the Tea Party movement that emerged in 2010 and part of disillusionment, obviously, with Obama and the health care bill, but also disillusionment with George W. Bush, and the Trump movement that we see today?
It's funny you mentioned that the other day. You know, the Tea Party came about to make great changes, but it's also more of a conservative movement. Which it's obvious Donald Trump is not a true conservative, so it's almost that in one aspect they're hand in hand, on the other part they're polar opposites. You know, Donald Trump, if you could even really call him a traditional Republican, is very moderate. The Tea Party is more conservative. So I've the people I've talked to from the Tea Party, they're not necessarily huge Trump supporters, but they certainly support him over the alternative. I would say if they were going to really support a candidate, it would probably be Gary Johnson. Being the libertarian, the more conservative with more, but at the same time, some, you know, liberal ideas as well. But I would think Johnson would be more of a Tea Party candidate versus a Trump.
Do you think that that the Tea Party, obviously responding to the Affordable Care Act and deficits and that kind of thing, that the people who constituted it, not necessarily the leadership, because we saw a lot of leadership come out of Washington, right? But that those were their issues, but they were like these other issues hanging out there that they could then, that they might have also been angry about, like, for instance, free trade.
Sure.
It didn't come up during that period, but nonetheless, if you had asked them in 2010, what do you think about free trade, they would have said, I don't like it. I mean, is there a larger menu of issues, perhaps, that where I was out there for the Tea Party movement? We just didn't see it until the Trump movement came along.
Well, the conservative movement is going to be things like the free trade. It's going to be about having immigration, but having it legalized, you know, or people, you know, legal. They're mostly the conservative ethic, like your Second Amendment rights, gun rights, you know, supporting the Constitution. Is that a big push in the Trump campaign? No, it's not. I mean, he talks about immigration, obviously, but does he really, really talk about the Constitution? That's where the Tea Party came in. That's where Ted Cruz really was a strong, candidate until he decided to quit. That's where the Tea Party normally stands. And again, from the people I spoke to that are involved with the Tea Party, Trump is not their ideal candidate at all.
What about that, Greg? Is there a connection between those two movements?
Yeah, I would agree that Trump is not the Tea Party's candidate. Ted Cruz certainly was.
Right.
And Donald just doesn't seem to fit in with that thinking. And, you know, the closest Tea Party person I know is our own Congressman Andy Harris. And, you know, love Andy Harris in a lot of ways. He's a very skilled and competent guy. He's a great politician, very smart man. But my problem with Andy and the Tea Party is they're so far out there on some things that we know how they're going to vote on everything for the rest of their lives. So, you know, basically Andy to me is like a computer. You know his position on every issue, and it's not going to change. He's not going to dial it down. He's, you know, he might not be as willing to compromise as some of the other people. And I think that's a shame. You know, the government needs that. You need, like the old Senate needed Ted Kennedy as much as it needed Jesse Helms. You know, you need that because that's a reflection of America. But it's a process up there, and you've got to be willing to compromise. You've got to be able to be willing to listen to all the different points of view to make legislation to make things better. And I worry about that with the Tea Party.
If I may, I'm so glad you brought up Andy Harris, because or another point, Kathy Schlega, because there's so much more that, as far as this race than just Trump.
Yeah, poor Kathy. I feel so bad for her this year.
I mean, well, she's got a tough fight with Van Hollen. But, you know, I spoke to Andy Harris's people. And, you know, speaking not just about Trump, but we're talking about security in our cities. You know, he's for that. You know, he's for the regulations of the EPA regulations on our chicken houses, our poultry industry. If you continuously choke out the local farmer, what do we have on the Eastern Shore? Really?
Yeah.
You know, and he's willing to fight for that. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, there's more to, than just the presidential race. There's our local, there's the Senate and Congress. I've spent time at our local Republican headquarters downtown. What do people ask for all the time? Trump signs, Trump signs, Trump signs. What about supporting the party as a whole? Look at the issues. Why are you voting for them versus just let's pick up the sign of a celebrity?
Do you think, by the way, as regionally speaking, the reason why people do not are getting excited about Andy Harris is not because they don't necessarily like him, mm-hmm. but
they just don't know about him.
They don't know about him, and the assumption is he's going to win.
There's no race.
Yeah. I mean, there's no race. Yeah. So therefore, I mean, if the only interesting race would have been, say, Jim Ireton, who right. has this sort of flamboyant personality, which would have been really interesting, but. You know, people just don't get excited.
I mean, if you want an exciting brawl, then look at Schlega versus Van Hollen. Now that's going to be a fight. That's a talk about an underdog fight.
Yeah, but you know. Then again, with Hillary doing so well in Maryland, she's going to be she's at 80% right now in the polls.
Yeah,
and that trickles down to Kathy. She doesn't have a prayer, so she could have made it a 60-40 race, perhaps, or been able to get out there and talk about some ideas. You know, play off the Hogan popularity somehow. But I think Donald Trump has killed her in Maryland, and people who might not want to go vote for Donald Trump are going to stay home. If they had a better presidential candidate, they would go there. They would vote for Kathy. And I think it's a shame. She's a good candidate. She's one of the better Republican,
very genuine,
candidates that we've had for the Senate in a long time.
I want to turn it back to the national for a moment, because one of the other things I was wondering about, particularly with this movement behind Trump, is whether or not. What do you think has been the effect of conservative media on the conservative movement? I mean, obviously we have Fox, but we also have talk radio. And then in the internet age, obviously we have anything from Judge to Breitbart. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact do you think that has had on people, and maybe separating us out? I mean, there are other people who like only watch MSNBC, for example. I mean, so that we seem to be much more divided than so perhaps that we were, say, in the past when we all sat around and there were only three networks. I mean, mm-hmm. What kind of role do you think that's played in this division of people and the angst that people feel? Because much of what's in the conservative media has been, things are out of control. We have to fight against Obama and so on and so forth.
I think it's given a voice to the conservative movement, mm-hmm. versus your typical like NBC, ABC, MSNBC, which is more, liberal slanted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I remember back in high school and college, we were taught in journalism it should be objective. Well, we know that's not true. We know that's not true. And for whatever reason, monetary reasons or whatever, but it's given a voice, especially in the age of the internet with Breitbart and Conservative Review and things like that. Now, at the same time, being objective, is it fair to the left? Probably not. Just so it's back and forth, tit for tat. But I think it has definitely given a voice to the conservative movement. It didn't necessarily help Cruz in the end. I was a Cruz supporter. It did not. Because again, it goes back to the cult of personality. Who's the biggest celebrity? Who can sell the most seats? But I would definitely say it's given a larger voice to a conservative movement.
What about you, Greg? I mean,
yeah, we've talked about this—the echo chamber. People, it's like a blanket. They want to be wrapped around viewpoints that they support. So you turn on Rush Limbaugh and you're listening to him, and you're like, yeah, 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 and it goes to commercial. So you feel good about what you're hearing. It's stuff that you are thinking or already know or believe. It reaffirms your beliefs, and it's very comforting. It's wonderful. So people have developed that with the mass media now. You can select whatever point of view that you want to hear, and you can listen to that, and it just reaffirms what you're thinking over and over again. Now, how educated do you become? How much do you learn? That's the open question. I force myself to listen to competing points of view just so I can try to understand things better. Mm-hmm. But I do, I detect, as someone who does this for, a living, I constantly detect bias all the time. You'll see reporters, they'll write a pretty balanced story, and then you go on their Twitter and you see their personal viewpoints on things, and you realize, wow, they're doing a pretty credible job as a reporter because they obviously hate whoever they just wrote about, and you didn't quite see that in the writing, mm-hmm. but you'll see that in their personal stuff. But then again, too, on these websites, too, sometimes I can't tell what's reporting what's news and what's opinion. So the Washington Post website's a good example. I'll see a headline and I'll start to read something and I'm like, oh my gosh, you can't say this in a balanced news report. And then I realize this is on the editorial page, or because it's not even in the paper, perhaps this is in an opinion area of this website. You know, so even as someone who's supposedly a trained professional, I can't figure out where it is. And I'm sure readers have the same problem.
And, you know, the thing that's confusing to me is that, like, I'd like to read the National Review articles, but they are against the chosen candidate of the Republican Party, you know, because they more of a conservative stand. But they will not. So then if somebody from just reading this stuff, well, who do I vote for him or don't I?
Right.
You know, the National Review was, you know, pretty high up as far as conservative publications. So they must be the real experts and they don't like Trump. But why is he the candidate?
Right. Well, you know, and you'll learn stuff. Read National Review. You'll learn stuff because there's a diversity. It sounds awful for me to say, you know, you'll learn. There's a diversity of views in National Review. But there is, because it's like The Economist and a lot of these other magazines. Mm-hmm. They really do research the issues and they tackle things from all different angles. So it's not a propaganda machine, I don't think. It's something that stimulates thought. And that's what's so important.
Well, in terms of these kinds of outlets, you know, particularly on the Internet, when we initially had Drudge and so on in the 90s. We have Breitbart and the rise of what we've now been called the alt-right that's kind of at least emerged and come to the surface. You know, they may have, you know, David Duke may, for instance, the former Klansman may have supported Republican efforts in the past, but he wasn't present. He had no presence at all. Now we've got this sort of Breitbart alt-right phenomenon going on. Greg, what do you make of that and how does that impact what we're seeing politically with Trump and all those folks? Because obviously Trump has brought in Stephen Bannon, who's obviously from Breitbart, for example. What does that mean in terms of your party?
Well, and this is where something has changed in terms of how information is delivered. It's no longer, we used to have the gatekeepers. You know, so the example I use is I went to college and school for a long time to learn what was news and what was not news, and to figure out how that applied to my community. So I got to be the editor guy, and I could pick the five stories that went on the front page every day that I thought that my readers needed to know. You know, there was interesting stuff, there was boring but important, but, you know, I was trained to select the news for my readership. Well, all that's gone now. There are no gatekeepers. It's just whatever voice is the loudest, whoever says the most inflammatory thing or the most interesting thing, whoever has the coolest link or picture that goes with it, you know, that's how it's changed. So everyone has a voice now. And it's a completely different thing in terms of people who are not trained as journalists, whatever that means or however important that is. You could argue about that. But it's sort of a self-aggrandizing thing. If you've got the coolest voice, people are going to listen to you. And they muck that up. Like Sean Hannity, is he a reporter or is he an opinion guy? Bill O'Reilly, I can tell he's an opinion guy, but he's also doing some reporting, and it just confuses that whole issue. But now there are no gatekeepers anymore. It's whatever makes the most noise and whatever is the hot report of the day.
Sean, are you concerned, by the way, about the influence of sort of what's been described anyway? So the right Breitbart wing, that is that there are all these elements that for instance, that certainly that William Buckley, we mentioned the National Review, would have dismissed without a yes. second thought. And yet now they've obviously reached into the national campaign, but they're coming to the surface. I mean, what about that in terms of the impact on your party?
Of course it bothers me. It's like using Wikipedia as primary sources to do a paper.
Exactly.
You know, it might be right. It might not be right. Because anybody, I could go in there and add on something in quantum physics. Is it going to be right? Probably not.
And there's a Buckley thing that exactly fits what you're saying. Arsenio Hall, remember when he was so hot and Clinton was going on there and not going on the other shows? And Arsenio Hall was giving press conferences about why Bill Clinton should be would be a good president. And people were writing that down as news stories. So Buckley actually had a line in National Review that said, he was talking about, he goes, Arsenio Hall, comma, whoever he is, comma. Okay, so in retrospect, in timing, does Arsenio Hall matter to our political process now? No, but in 1992, he was a big deal.
Yeah, he was. He was.
Have we moved into the area or the era of celebrities so that people do pay attention to people who don't necessarily have...
Sean made the point with the signs. You know, they want a celebrity sign in their yard.
They do.
I used to love to watch The Apprentice.
You know, it's not really a matter of what you're saying. It's how you say it. You know, if you say it loud enough and with the right slant, people are going to listen. if I say something that, even if it's incorrect, if people like how it sounds, people are going to jump on that wagon.
Finally, what do you think is going to be the impact of the Trump candidacy? I mean, do you think it's going to be something of a blip and then it's going to disappear? Or do you think it could have some lasting effects, particularly when it comes to, say, for instance, minorities, the Hispanic community in particular? Some people are comparing this to California and we're basically after a particular anti-immigrant proposition, as at least perceived, it's been gone. It's the GOP has statewide doesn't have anything left to give. Do you think how lasting is this going to be? And obviously, there's talk about the impact on even the party's appeal to women.
If Trump, or more importantly, the Republican Party can make clear that nobody ever said in the Trump campaign or any conservative campaign, we are not for immigration. The only thing any of us have ever said was that we just want it to be legal. This is what America is about. It started with immigration. We weren't everybody in this room here are part of immigration. As long as it's legal, it's not right for, you know, we do not want billions of dollars of aid going to undocumented people that we can't vet. And we can't, you know, trace in any sense. The only thing we ever said was that make sure that it's legal so we can, you know, and bring these people to a quick citizenship.
But the way it's been handled, it seems that there is a certain amount of antagonism to the Hispanic group. Just a couple of seconds. What about you, Greg? Is this going to have a lasting effect on that party?
Yeah, I think I don't know how they're going to rebuild the Republican Party. I wonder about that. I don't know if the Tea Party people can rebuild it or how it's going to be rebuilt. I kind of hope that maybe the Trump movement and the people who feel like Trump, that they can create the third party out of this, I guess. I don't know. But I don't know what's going to happen now to the Republican Party. It's being attacked on all sides by its candidate and by the Democrats. I'm really concerned about what next for Republicans.
We've been speaking with Sean Bradley. He's with the Wicomico-Honey Republican Party, also Greg Bassett, the Salisbury Independent, and appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
I'm Tom Pittman, and I hope you'll be joining me this Friday night at 8 for Vintage Country. We'll be bringing you lots of the best of country music, and at the top of the second hour, we'll be bringing you the top 10 for the year 1965 here on WSDL.
The Life Crisis Center in Salisbury is celebrating its 40th anniversary. So what has changed during that time? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The center estimates 1 in 4 girls will be sexually abused before the age of 18, and less than 30% of sex crimes are reported to police, and that domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women between the ages of 15 and 44. This is despite the great strides of the women's movement that brought about greater awareness of these issues. We sat down with Michelle Hughes, Executive Director of Life Crisis Center, to talk about how we have come to this point.
Well, unfortunately, domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, child abuse, suicide, those kinds of things don't go away. And I think that when you start an organization like this, I think the goal is always that you'll eliminate the problem. The reality is that that doesn't happen. And we've recently taken on a program to do something which I didn't think was ever going to be necessary on the Lower Shore, and that is support for survivors of homicide victims.
How did you get into that?
Well, it I think is a natural progression almost, because many of the homicides that have occurred on the shore in the last 10 years have been domestic homicides. And so we felt that in order to continue to support the surviving members of the family, that it was something we had to do. This year, however, or in the past fiscal year, what we've seen is a number of child deaths. Toddlers, infants killed by a family member or a care provider. And that's been very difficult, both for the families, obviously, but also for my staff, because it's very difficult to try to support people when you're, because of what you do for a living, you already have a great deal of empathy for children. We have supported family members at the trial of two perpetrators of child deaths, one in Worcester County and one in Wicomico County. And it takes a toll on the staff to do that.
Is there any different kind of approach you take for the family in terms of that kind of death?
Yeah, all of our approaches are trauma-informed. My staff is extraordinarily well-prepared, well-trained and certified in trauma care. And when you deal with victims of trauma, there's a line between, it's not like talk therapy. You know, you don't just let them talk and pat them on the hand and tell them that they're right. You can't do that. What you have to do is actively help them to learn some coping skills, to learn to recognize that this is never going to go away. However, there are some ways that you can learn to deal with it so that you can move on with your life. And that's what the members of my staff who deal with these things directly have learned to do, are certified to do, and do extraordinarily well.
I mean, how difficult is it to get over a loss like that? I mean, does anyone ever, for instance, get over a loss?
You never get over the loss of a child. To me, it's even unthinkable. The idea that you should lose a child, especially one of these children was 3, the other one was 18 months old. So these are very young children. We have a case coming up in which there was a less than a month old baby, a shaken baby syndrome, and the child died. Those kinds of things are very difficult to get over. It's even hard for law enforcement and for Child Protective Services, those folks who go out to investigate those cases. It's one of the most difficult things that they have to do.
Turning to the issue of sexual abuse and assault and so on, we've had a lot of discussion over the last few years, certainly with a lot of athletes. Now, obviously, in the presidential campaign, we get a lot of discussion about misogyny at the very least. Do you think we've learned anything from these discussions? What is the atmosphere changed in any way, you think?
I think we recognize the animal when we see it. We recognize misogyny. We have begun to recognize that some of these comments that in past people said, oh, well, that's just the way men are. Men don't have to be that way. Not all men are like that. And the fact that we talk about it more is encouraging. However, having said that, men who are in power, or even young men who anticipate having that power, the athlete, the leaders, you know, the people who've already been identified as being the kind of men who have it, whatever it is, we give them something, some special dispensation, I think. Certainly there are women who want to be around those kinds of men and who want the prestige that those being with those kinds of men attract. At the same time, that doesn't mean that these women need to subordinate their own understanding of what's right. But until we train our boy children to understand that women, that they need to respect girls and women, and that they should treat them as equals, that is never going to happen. And unfortunately, in our society, we don't teach our boys to respect girls in the same way that they respect other boys.
How do you think that can be overcome? I mean, when I was growing up, there was very little in terms of, it's certainly formal instruction. If you got anything at all, it was from your family, your parents, or your peers. Is that changing? And are we Are there some solution or set of solutions to that? I mean, we all say we should teach our boys differently, but then how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, well, I think that a part of that is comes from the home. That if dad treats mother as an equal, if dad respects mother and respects other women as equals, if the father in the home treats the mother in the home as he would treat his own mother, then we might have, that starts it. Boys who were raised to respect girls are very, they don't act the same way as boys who have been raised in a home where the women in the home aren't respected. And it really does start in the home. But what we also have to recognize is that by middle school, boys are treated differently by educators than girls are.
In what sense?
There's a lot of research that says that by the time kids get to middle school, boys get called on more than girls. And, of course, in elementary school, it's the opposite. Girls get called on more because girls mature faster than boys. And so they are more ready for school than boys are. But by middle school, that has changed, and the boys get called on more by their teachers. The boys get more attention from their teachers than the girls. And so the girls begin to suspect that what they have to say is not as worthy. And that's something that needs to change. And these things take time, and we have come a long way from certainly when I was a girl. However, it's taken a much longer time than one would have expected.
As I think about certainly when I was growing up, even 20 or 30 years ago, a much different atmosphere than today. I mean, on a political level, I can remember Hillary Clinton, who became the first lady, and she took on a role that was much different than the past.
And was vilified for it.
So there has been some this dramatic change, but you're saying that it's...
It's not there yet.
Yeah.
Women are not the equal to men. When we still talk about the presidential look, that is code for presidents are men. It is. And we can't pretend that it doesn't exist. Women are in all sorts of fields now. When I was a girl, if you went to college, you could be a teacher or a nurse or a social worker. Now, for my daughters, their lives have been unlimited. You know, one of my girls is a physician, and one is an accountant, and one is a lawyer. That would not have happened when I was their age. And so that's a huge improvement, but we're not there yet.
Do you think that set of opportunities gets reflected in the fact, and I've talked to a number of young women in their 20s and 30s, who when they look at Hillary Clinton, first woman president of the United States, perhaps, not particularly impressed with that. They have other issues.
Yeah. They don't remember a time when women's role in the world was limited. They don't remember a time when women didn't have rights. Even simple things like inheritance. There was a time in this country when women could not inherit. And so, you know, we have to recognize where we've been. And we have come a long way. But just like it wouldn't occur to me that I don't have the equal right to inherit from my parents that my brother has, it doesn't occur to my daughters that they don't have the equal right to be whatever they have the ability to be in their lives. It's natural, but we have to be vigilant about the loss of rights that we've gained.
Turning to sexual abuse, because I ran into a number of statistics, which I don't have in front of me, but which there seems to be far more prevalent than one would expect.
Well, I think that there are a couple of reasons for it. One is that it's not something that people want to talk about. You know, in this country still, sex is something which, while it sells, is not something that we want to talk about when it's our daughters or our sisters. We certainly don't want to talk about are young men perpetrating sexual assault. What we have to remember is that sexual assault is not about sex. It's about anger and power. And when some young men or some men feel that they're angry and they feel as though they are disempowered, then what they look for is someone who is weaker than they to take it out on. And often that's a woman. And the way that you most demean a woman is by sexually assaulting her.
What explains the prevalence of sexual assault? I mean, there's some pretty high statistics for, particular girls under the age of 17, for example. What is driving that stat?
I think there are a couple of things. First is that in some cases, young women feel they don't have any option. You hear these horror stories about middle schoolers in school performing all sorts of sex acts in the classroom. And it's happening all over the place. And it's really it's very worrying. But I think that a part of it is that what they see on TV and in their video games and that sort of thing. And when you're 13 or 14, you think that being 21 is the, other end of the world, because it's another third of your life until you get there. And there's a lot of pressure on middle schoolers especially, which is a very hard time for kids. And so there's pressure put on them to act older and to do things that they might otherwise not do and that they're very uncomfortable doing. When we talk to these kids, what we find is that, they felt they had to do it because of peer pressure. And that's a really tough thing for a kid to have to resist peer pressure at that age. I also think that at a time like now, where you see this feeling among especially white men that they are being disenfranchised and that their power is taken away because other groups of people, women, minority males, are gaining more rights, and they feel that the rights that other people are gaining are taking some of theirs away. Some of their jobs are going away. They don't have that power at home because it's illegal to smack your wife around in most states. So there is this feeling of powerlessness. And as a result of that, things happen that might otherwise not.
Do you think that we've learned anything in terms of the kind of attention, for instance, that a lot of the athletes, we've had a number of them, has it brought more attention to it? And if so, has that helped any at all in terms of getting at men who say might, ordinarily say, hit somebody and then say, wait a minute, maybe that's what I shouldn't do? Or does it work that way?
I don't think it does. When someone comes in a down economy, and we've had a down economy, what happens is that the boss says something to you or the boss disrespects you in some way, you can't hit back at the boss. And so you go home and you smack your wife or your kids around. And it's just, it's a matter of frustration. So that's what happens in those cases, is that you see in a down economy that domestic violence goes up, child abuse goes up, and we expect those things. We prepare for the cyclic nature of the economy, and that our business goes up when the economy goes down. But I think that then what happens is that people, even when they get a job after that kind of experience, it may not be the same kind of job that they had before. It may not be at the same level. And even if it is, that insecurity remains. You've lost a job once, it could happen again. And so because men feel very insecure at those times, there is that tendency to fly off the handle at home or to take it out on the wife or the children. And it's very worrying, but I don't think that it's something that is not, that we can't explain.
Do you think that if the economy improves over a general period of time, that people may perhaps might feel more economically secure as opposed to what they obviously do now? Do you then expect a decline in that kind of behavior?
Yeah. Once before we had that, when in the mid to late 90s, we had a remarkable run of really good economic times. Between the Bill Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration, the percentage of domestic violence in the country went down. So at the first part of the Clinton administration, one in three women were victims of domestic violence. And by the end of the Clinton administration, the first part of the Bush administration, it went up to one in four. So we had a decrease in domestic violence because the economy for so long was doing so well. And then toward the end, at the beginning of the last recession, you saw the numbers start to creep up a little bit. And so right now it's about one in, down a little bit now. So it's about one in three and a half, something like that. So there was a difference, and it's all economically driven.
You're talking about the insecurity of men, particularly in economic times. Mm-hmm. Are we placing too much responsibility on the men who see themselves either as breadwinners? Certainly, they tie their own personal dignity in the work they do, not necessarily always in their children, which may be a somewhat different thing for women. And that there's this changing role that's going on, as obviously women and other folks in particular participate in the economy, competing more for this one thing that men say, hey, you know, I'm this or I'm that when I talk about my profession.
Absolutely. There isn't any question that for so long, how men have seen themselves is as the man, the breadwinner, the person who, you know, brings home the bacon. And as that has evolved over the years, now in many households, of course, both parties work. And in some households, actually, women make more money. And a part of that is because right now in colleges in this country, there are more women than men enrolled. And women have a tendency in larger numbers to finish college. And so they are eligible to make more money than their husbands. And I think that that's something we need to take into account. But we have to move to the point where if we're all going to be equal partners, that we have to expect equal participation in all ways. And that means that we have to account for the fact that women possibly make as much money as men or more, and that then they have equal responsibility. Because you hear in many households where, you know, my husband lost his job and we have a problem. Well, my personal view is that if you are equal partners in the relationship and your husband's lost his job and you can get a job, why don't you? You know, and that's sort of my personal feeling about it, that if we're equal, then we need to be equal all the way around. And that means that we have to share in whatever it is we're doing as partners, in the making of money, in the spending of the money, in the raising of the children, in the making of the home. And that's equality when everybody does this, you know, half of the work. That's not normally what happens in most households. And I think until we get to the point where men and women are equal in those kinds of ways, they can't really be said to, we can't be said to have an equal society.
That takes an attitude shift.
It does.
I mean, obviously from both people.
Mm-hmm. And the society at large. Because the society doesn't really expect that.
Are we getting there at all?
we've moved some ways.
Oh, do you think that we'll be going through this period for some time because we are trying to figure out this new relationship that exists between men and women? Because, I mean, one of the observations I always make is, and you can tell me whether I'm true or not, is that women used to have a full-time job at home. It took all day to do anything, right? Technology comes along and basically wipes out their job. You know, you can wash clothes and watch the TV at the same time. It doesn't take as much
time,
right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And it seems now that it's all beginning to catch up and that women are now participating in the workforce in part because that job that they used to have is now gone. So it seems to me that we're now entering a period where it's going to take an awful lot of adjustment to move away from that set of attitudes, which probably made sense back then, because if you had a full-time job taking care of the house, well, that's what you did, right? To now, you don't have to have that job anymore. That job disappears.
That's a very enlightened attitude, Don. when I was a girl, my mother, Monday was laundry day. It took all day to do the laundry. And, you know, there was the wringer washing machine. And
I remember them.
You hung your laundry out on the lines to dry. So it was an all-day job. As with the advent of technology, that job has disappeared. And unfortunately, as a society, we haven't recognized that that is what happened, that women were put out of a job. And so they had to look for other jobs. And that's a very valid point. And what it means is that now women compete with men for jobs.
But we still have this one other job out there, which is the raising of kids.
Yes.
Or caregivers, which generally mm-hmm. women are still the general caregiver. How mm-hmm. does that little piece fit into this changing tableau that we see?
That makes it more difficult. There isn't any question. You know, traditionally, the care of children has been the job of women. As a society, younger men are much more involved in the upbringing of children. I look at some of the young men that I deal with, and they are doing they're doing things like doing the carpool, taking the kids to school, you know, picking the kids up from school. I have a woman on my staff who's a lawyer. She has kids. Her husband is basically the soccer mom because he is more available during the day, even though he has a full-time job. He can build his schedule around the kids' activities. And she can't because she's a lawyer and she's in court all day. And so their roles have changed a great deal because of his ability to be flexible and her lack of flexibility because of her job. So I think it is changing, and I see it among my younger staff. And I think it's encouraging that young men are taking much more interest and time in the raising of their kids. As a matter of fact, there's a commercial on television right now for, I don't know, faucet, that is all about a young father and an infant, and he's bathing the child at the kitchen sink and using this incredible faucet.
Right.
And he calls it father-son bonding time. And that's something you never would have seen on TV even 10 years ago, a man bathing an infant. You know, but it says something about our society that we've moved in the direction of fathers having a larger part, a larger role in the raising of their children.
So it's 40 years. What kind of change do you think you've seen in the problems that you...
Well, now we have laws against things like domestic violence, which we didn't have 40 years ago. And the Life Crisis Center started actually as a rape crisis program at the Rape Crisis Center of Ocean City. And we were an all-volunteer organization that basically was the hotline talking to victims of rape, mostly starting in Ocean City, of course, and helping them to get through what is arguably one of the most horrific things that could happen to them in their lives. Then, you know, we got into the domestic violence and the child abuse and things that are a natural outgrowth of that. So now we are a regional trauma center.
We've been speaking with Michelle Hughes, Executive Director, Life Crisis Center in Salisbury. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.